Chapter 33. While Larry Underwood was taking his 4th of July spill only a state away, Stuart Redman was sitting on a large rock at the side of the road and eating his lunch. He heard the sound of approaching engines. He finished his can of beer at a swallow and carefully folded over the top of the waxed paper tube the Ritz crackers were in. His rifle was leaning against the rock beside him. He picked it up, flicked off the safety catch, and then put it down again, a little closer to hand. Motorcycles coming, small ones by the sound. 250s? In this great stillness, it was impossible to tell how far away they were. 10 miles, maybe, but only maybe. Plenty of time to eat more if he wanted to, but he didn't. In the meantime, the sun was warm, and the thought of meeting fellow creatures pleasant. He had seen no living people since leaving Glenn Bateman's house in Woodsville. He glanced at the rifle again. He had flicked the safety because the fellow creatures might turn out to be like Elder. He had left the rifle leaning against the rock because he hoped they would be like Bateman, only maybe not quite so glum about the future. Society will reappear, Bateman had said. Notice I didn't use the word reform. That would have been a ghastly pun. There's precious little reform in the human race. Bateman himself had seemed perfectly content, at least for the time being, to go for his walks with Kojak, paint his pictures, and think about the sociological ramifications of nearly total decimation. If you come back this way and renew your invitation to gine up, Stu, I'll probably agree. That is the curse of the human race. Sociability. What Christ should have said was, "Yea, verily, whenever two or three of you are gathered together, some other guy is going to get the living shit kicked out of him." Shall I tell you what sociology teaches us about the human race? I'll give it to you in a nutshell. Show me a man or woman alone, and I'll show you a saint. Give me two, and they'll fall in love. Give me three, and they'll invent that charming thing we call society. Give me four, and they'll build a pyramid. Give me five, and they'll make one an outcast. Give me six, and they'll reinvent prejudice. Give me seven, and in 7 years, they'll reinvent warfare. Man may have been made in the image of God, but human society was made in the image of his opposite number, and is always trying to get back home. Was that true? If it was, then God help them. Just lately, Stu had been thinking a great deal about old friends and acquaintances. In his memory, there was a great tendency to downplay or completely forget their unlovable characteristics. The way Bill Hapscom used to pick his nose and wipe the snot on the sole of his shoe. Norm Brouette's heavy hand with his kids. Billy Varecker's unpleasant method of controlling the cat population around his house by crushing the thin skulls of the new kittens under the heels of his Range Rider boots. The thoughts that came wanted to be wholly good, going hunting at dawn, bundled up in quilted jackets and day-glow orange vests, poker games at Ralph Hodges' house, and Willie Craddock always complaining about how he was $4 in the game, even if he was 20 ahead. 6 or 7 of them pushing Tony Leominster's scout back onto the road that time he went down into the ditch drunk out of his mind, Tony staggering around and swearing to God and all the saints that he had swerved to avoid a U-Haul full of Mexican wetbacks. Jesus, how they had laughed. Chris Ortega's endless stream of ethnic jokes, going down to Huntsville for whores, and that time Joe Bob Brentwood caught the crabs and tried to tell everybody they came from the sofa in the parlor and not from the girl upstairs. They had been goddamn good times. Not what your sophisticates with their nightclubs and their fancy restaurants and their museums would think of as good times, maybe, but good times just the same. He thought about those things, went over them and over them, the way an old recluse will lay out hand after hand of solitaire. Mostly he wanted to hear other human voices, get to know someone, be able to turn to someone and say, "Did you see that?" when something happened like the meteor shower he had watched the other night. So he sat up a little straighter when the motorcycles finally swept around the bend, and he saw they were a couple of Honda 250s, ridden by a boy of about 18 and a pretty girl who was maybe older than the boy. The girl was wearing a bright yellow blouse and light blue Levi's. They saw him sitting on the rock, and both Hondas swerved a little as their driver's surprise caused control to waver briefly. The boy's mouth dropped open. For a moment, it was unclear whether they would stop or just speed by heading west. Stu raised an empty hand and said, "Hi," in an amiable voice. His heart was beating heavily in his chest. He wanted them to stop. They did. For a moment, he was puzzled by the tenseness in their postures, particularly the boy. He looked as if a gallon of adrenaline had just been dumped into his blood. Of course, Stu had a rifle, but he wasn't holding it on them, and they were armed themselves. He was wearing a pistol, and she had a small deer rifle slung across her back on a strap, like an actress playing Patty Hearst with no great conviction. "I think he's all right, Harold," the girl said, but the boy she called Harold continued to stand astride his bike, looking at Stu with an expression of surprise and considering antagonism. "I said, I think," she began again. "How are we supposed to know that?" "Well, I'm glad to see you, if that makes any difference," Stu said. "What if I don't believe you?" Harold challenged. And Stu saw that he was scared green, scared by him and by his responsibility to the girl. Stu climbed off the rock. Harold's hand jittered toward his holstered pistol. "Harold, you leave that alone," the girl said. Then she fell silent, and for a moment they all seemed helpless to proceed further. A group of three dots which, when connected, would form a triangle whose exact shape could not yet be foreseen. "Ooh," Franny said, easing herself down. "I'm never going to get the calluses off my fanny, Harold." Harold uttered a surly grunt. She turned to Stu. "Have you ever ridden 170 miles on a Honda, Mr. Redmond?" "Not recommended." Stu smiled. "Where are you headed?" "What business is it of yours?" Harold asked rudely. "And what kind of attitude is that?" Fran asked him. "Mr. Redmond is the first person we've seen since Gus Dinsmore died. I mean, if we didn't come looking for other people, what did we come for?" "He's watching out for you, is all," Stu said quietly. "That's right, I am," Harold said, unmollified. "I thought we were watching out for each other," she said, and Harold flushed darkly. Stu thought, give me three people and they'll form a society. But were these the right two for his one? He liked the girl, but the boy impressed him as a frightened blowhard. "We're going to Stovington, Vermont," Franny said, "to the plague center there. What's wrong, Mr. Redmond?" He had gone pale all of a sudden, and the stem of grass he had been chewing fell onto his lap. "Why there?" Stu asked. "Because there happens to be an installation there for the studying of communicable diseases," Harold said loftily. "It was my thought that if there is any order left in this country, or any persons in authority who escaped the late scourge, they would likely be at Stovington or in Atlanta, where there is another such center." "That's right," Franny said. Stu said, "You're wasting your time." Franny looked stunned. Harold looked indignant. The red began to creep out of his collar again. "I hardly think you're the best judge of that, my man." "I guess I am. I came from there." Now they both looked stunned. Stunned and astonished. "You knew about it?" Franny asked, shaken. "You checked it out?" "No, it wasn't like that. You're a liar!" Harold's voice had gone high and squeaky. Fran saw an alarming cold flash of anger in Redmond's eyes. Then they were brown and mild again. "No, I ain't."
"I say you are. I say you're nothing but a..." "Harold, you shut up." "But, Franny, how can you believe... How can you be so rude and antagonistic?" she asked hotly. "Will you at least listen to what he has to say, Harold?"
"I don't trust him."
"Fair enough," Stu thought. "That makes us even."
"How can you not trust a man you just met? Really, Harold, you're being disgusting."
"Let me tell you how I know," Stu said quietly.
He told an abridged version of the story that began when Campion had crashed into Hap's gas pumps. He sketched his escape from Stovington a week ago. Harold glared dully down at his hands, which were plucking up bits of moss and shredding them. But the girl's face was like an unfolding map of a tragic country, and Stu felt bad for her. She had set off with this boy, who, to give him credit due, had had a pretty good idea, hoping against hope that there was something of the old ways left. Well, she had been disappointed. Bitterly so, from her look.
Atlanta, too? The plague got both of them? She asked.
Yes, he said. And she burst into tears. He wanted to comfort her, but the boy would not take to that. Harold glanced uncomfortably at Fran, then down at the litter of moss on his cuffs. Stu gave her his handkerchief. She thanked him distractedly without looking up. Harold glared sullenly at him again, the eyes those of a piggy little boy who wants the whole cookie jar to himself. Ain't he going to be surprised, Stu thought, when he finds out a girl isn't a jar of cookies? When her tears had tapered down to sniffles, she said,
I guess Harold and I owe you our thanks. At least you saved us a long trip with disappointment at the end.
You mean you believe him? Just like that? He tells you a big story and you buy it? Harold, why would he lie? For what gain?
Well, how do I know what he's got on his mind? Harold asked truculently. Murder could be, or rape.
I don't believe in rape myself, Stu said mildly. Maybe you know something about it I don't.
Stop it, Fran said. Harold, won't you try not to be so awful?
Awful, Harold shouted. I'm trying to watch out for you, us, and that's so bloody damn awful.
Look, Stu said, and brushed his sleeve up. On the inside of his elbow were several healing needle marks and the last remains of a discolored bruise. They injected me with all kinds of stuff.
Maybe you're a junkie, Harold said.
Stu rolled his sleeve back down without replying. It was the girl, of course. He had gotten used to the idea of owning her. Well, some girls could be owned and some could not. This one looked like the latter type. She was tall and pretty and very fresh-looking. Her dark eyes and hair accentuated a look that could be taken for dewy helplessness. It would be easy to miss that faint line, the I want line, Stu's mother had called it, between her eyebrows that became so pronounced when she was put out, the swift capability of her hands, even the forthright way she tossed her hair from her forehead.
So now what do we do?
She asked, ignoring Harold's last contribution to the discussion entirely.
Go on anyway, Harold said. And when she looked over at him with that line furrowing her brow, he added hastily, Well, we have to go somewhere.
Sure, he's probably telling the truth, but we could double-check, then decide what's next. Fran glanced at Stu. Stu shrugged.
Okay, Harold pressed.
I suppose it doesn't matter, Franny said. She picked up a gone-to-seed dandelion and blew away the fluff.
You haven't seen anyone at all? Stu asked.
No one. Stu told them about Bateman and Kojak. When he had finished, he said, I was going toward the coast, but you saying there aren't any people back that way kind of takes the wind out of my sails.
Sorry, Harold said, sounding anything but. He stood up. Ready, Fran?
She looked at Stu, hesitated, then stood up. Back to the wonderful diet machine. Thank you for telling us what you know, Mr. Redman, even if the news wasn't so hot.
Just a second, Stu said, also standing up.
He hesitated, wondering again if they were right. The girl was, but the boy surely was 17 and afflicted with a bad case of the I hate most everybody's. But were there enough people left to pick and choose? Stu thought not.
I guess we're both looking for people, he said. I'd like to tag along with you if you'd have me.
No, Harold said instantly. Fran looked at Harold.
Maybe we... You never mind, I say no.
Don't I get a vote?
What's the matter with you? Can't you see he only wants one thing? Christ, Fran.
Three's better than two if there's trouble, Stu said.
No, Harold repeated. His hand dropped to the butt of his gun.
Yes, Fran said. We'd be glad to have you, Mr. Redman.
Harold rounded on her, his face angry and hurt.
That's the way you feel, is it? You were just waiting for some excuse to get rid of me. I get it.
He was so angry that tears had sprung to his eyes, and that made him angrier still.
If that's the way you want it, okay, you go on with him. I'm done with you.
He stamped off toward where the Hondas were parked.
Franny looked at Stu with stricken eyes, then turned toward Harold.
Just a minute, Stu said. Stay here, please.
He trotted toward Harold, who was astride his Honda, and trying to start it up. In his anger, he had twisted the throttle all the way over, and it was a good thing for him it was flooded, Stu thought. If it actually started up with that much throttle, it would rear back on its rear wheel like a unicycle and pile old Harold into the first tree and land on top of him.
You stay away,
Harold screamed angrily at him, and his hand fell onto the butt of the gun again. Stu put his hand on top of Harold's, as if they were playing slapjack. He put his other hand on Harold's arm. Harold's eyes were very wide, and Stu believed he was only an inch or so from becoming dangerous. He wasn't just jealous of the girl. That had been a bad oversimplification on his part. His personal dignity was wrapped up in it, and his new image of himself as the girl's protector. God knew what kind of a fuck-up he had been before all of this, with his wad of belly and his pointy-toed boots and his stuck-up way of talking. But underneath the new image was the belief that he was still a fuck-up and always would be. He would have reacted the same way to Bateman, or to a 12-year-old kid. In any triangle situation, he was going to see himself as the lowest point. Harold, he said, almost into Harold's ear.
Let me go.
His heavy body seemed light in its tension. He was thrumming like a live wire. Harold, are you sleeping with her? Harold's body gave a shivering jerk, and Stu knew he was not.
None of your business.
No, except to get things out where we can see them. She's not mine, Harold. She's her own. I'm not going to take her away from you. I'm sorry to have to speak so blunt, but it's best for us to know where we stand. We're 2-1 now, and if you go off, we're 2-1 again. No gain. Harold said nothing, but his trembling had subsided. I'll be just as plain as I have to. You know and I know that there's no need for a man to be raping women, not if he knows what to do with his hand.
That's...
Harold licked his lips and then looked over at the side of the road where Fran was still standing, hands cupping elbows, arms crossed just below her breasts, watching them anxiously.
That's pretty disgusting.
Well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. But when a man's around a woman who doesn't want him in bed, that man's got his choice. I pick the hand every time. I guess you do too, since she's still with you of her own free will. I just want to speak plain between you and me. I'm not here to squeeze you out like some bully at a county fair dance. Harold's hand relaxed on the gun, and he looked at Stu.
You mean that? You promise you won't tell?
Stu nodded.
I love her, Harold said hoarsely. She doesn't love me, I know that, but I'm speaking plainly like you said.
That's best. I don't want to cut in. I just want to come along. Compulsively, Harold repeated,
You promise?
Yeah, I do.
All right.
He got slowly off the Honda. He and Stu walked back to Fran.
He can come, Harold said. And I...
He looked at Stu and said with difficult dignity,
I apologize for being such an asshole.
Hooray, Fran said and clapped her hands. Now that that's settled, where are we going? In the end, they went in the direction Fran and Harold had been headed in, west. Stu said he thought Glenn Bateman would be glad to have them overnight, if they could reach Woodsville by dark, and he might agree to tag along with them in the morning. At this, Harold began to glower again. Stu drove Fran's Honda, and she rode Pillion behind Harold. They stopped in Twin Mountain for lunch and began the slow, cautious business of getting to know each other. They ate in an abandoned lunchroom, and Stu found his gaze was drawn again and again to Fran's face, her lively eyes, the small but determined set of her chin, the way that line formed between her eyes, indexing her emotions. He liked the way she looked and talked. He even liked the way her dark hair was drawn back from her temples. And that was the beginning of his knowing that he did want her, after all. Book 2. On the Border. July 5th to September 6th, 1980. We come on the ship they call the Mayflower,
we come on the ship that sailed the moon. We come in the age's most uncertain hour and sing an American tune. But it's all right, it's all right. You can't be forever blessed. Paul Simon. Looking hard for a drive-in, searching for a parking space, where hamburgers sizzle on an open grill night and day. Yes, jukebox is jumping with records back in the USA. Well, I'm so glad I'm living in the USA. Anything you want, we got it right here in the USA. Chuck Berry. Chapter 34. There was a dead man lying in the middle of Main Street in May, Oklahoma. Nick wasn't surprised. He had seen a lot of corpses since leaving Shoyo, and he suspected he hadn't seen a thousandth of all the dead people he must have passed. In places, the rich smell of death on the air was enough to make you feel like swooning. One more dead man, more or less, wasn't going to make any difference. But when the dead man sat up, such an explosion of terror rose in him that he again lost control of his bike. It wavered, then wobbled, then crashed, spilling Nick violently onto the pavement of Oklahoma Route 3. He cut his hands and scraped his forehead. "Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble," the corpse said, coming toward Nick at a pace best described as an amiable stagger. "Didn't you just? My laws!" Nick got none of this. He was wondering how badly he was hurt from this second spill in less than a week. Blood from his cut forehead splattered on the pavement. When the hand touched him on the shoulder, he remembered the corpse and scrambled away on the palms of his hands and the soles of his shoes, his eyes bright with terror. "Don't you take on so," the corpse repeated. And Nick saw he was looking happily at Nick. He had most of a bottle of whiskey in one hand, and now Nick understood. Not a corpse, but a man who had gotten drunk and had passed out in the middle of the road. Nick nodded at him and made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. Then a drop of blood oozed warmly into the eye that Ray Booth had worked over, making it smart. He wiped his forearm across it, and then walked slowly to the curb and sat beside a Plymouth with Kansas plates, which was slowly settling on its tires. He could see the gash on his forehead reflected in the Plymouth's bumper. It looked ugly, but not deep. He would find the local drugstore, disinfect it, and slap a Band-Aid over it. He thought he still must have enough penicillin in his system to fight off almost anything, but his close call from the scrape on his leg had given him a horror of infection. He picked scraps of gravel out of his palms, wincing. The man with the bottle of whiskey had been watching all of this with no expression at all. If Nick had looked up, it would have struck him as queer immediately. When he had turned away to examine his wound in the bumper's reflection, the animation had leaked out of the man's face. It became empty and clean and unlined. He was wearing bibs that were clean but faded and heavy work shoes. He stood about 5'9", and his hair was so blonde it was nearly white. His eyes were a bright, empty blue, and with the corn silk hair, his Swedish or Norwegian descent was unmistakable. He looked no more than 23, but Nick found out later he had to be 40 or close to it, because he could remember the end of World War II and how his daddy had come home in uniform a month later. There was no question that he might have made it all up. Invention was not Tom Cullen's long suit. He stood there, empty of face, like a robot whose plug has been pulled. Then, little by little, animation seeped back into his face. His whiskey-reddened eyes began to twinkle. He smiled. He had remembered again what this situation called for. "Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble, didn't you just? My laws!" He blinked at the amount of blood on Nick's forehead. Nick had a pad of paper and a Bic in his shirt pocket. Neither had been jarred loose by the fall. He wrote, "You just scared me. I saw two people east of here, but no one since then. Thought you were dead until you sat up. I'm okay. Is there a drugstore in town?" He showed the pad to the man in the bibs. The man took it, looked at what was written there, handed it back. Smiling, he said, "I'm Tom Cullen, but I can't read. I only got to third grade, but then I was 16 and my daddy made me quit. He said I was too big." Retarded, Nick thought. I can't talk and he can't read. For a moment, he was utterly nonplussed. Holy gee, mister, but you took a tumble, Tom Cullen exclaimed. In a way, it was the first time for both of them. My laws, didn't you just?
Nick nodded, replaced the pad and pen, put a hand over his mouth and shook his head, cupped his hands over his ears and shook his head, placed his left hand against his throat and shook his head. Cullen grinned, puzzled.
Got a toothache? I had one once. Gee, it hurt, didn't it, just? My laws.
Nick shook his head and went through his dumb show again. Cullen guessed earache this time. Nick threw his hands up and went over to his bike. The paint was scraped, but it didn't seem hurt. He got on and pedaled a little way up the street. Yes, it was all right. Cullen jogged alongside, smiling happily. His eyes never left Nick. He hadn't seen anyone for most of a week.
Don't you feel like talking?
He asked, but Nick didn't look around or appear to have heard. Tom tugged at his sleeve and repeated his question. The man on the bike put his hand over his mouth again and shook his head. Tom frowned. Now the man had put his bike on his kickstand and was looking at the storefront. He seemed to see what he wanted because he went over to the sidewalk and then to Mr. Norton's drugstore. If he wanted to go in there, it was just too bad because the drug was locked up. Mr. Norton had left town. Just about everybody had locked up and left town, it seemed like, except for Mom and her friend Mrs. Blakely, and they were both dead. Now the no-talking man was trying the door. Tom could have told him it was no use even though the open sign was on the door. The open sign was a liar. Too bad, because Tom would dearly have loved an ice cream soda. It was a lot better than the whiskey, which had made him feel good at first, and then made him sleepy, and then had made his headache fit to split. He had gone to sleep to get away from the headache, but he had had a lot of crazy dreams about a man in a black suit like the one that Reverend Diefenbaker always wore. The man in the black suit chased him through the dreams. He seemed like a very bad man to Tom. The only reason he had gone to drinking in the first place was because he wasn't supposed to. His daddy had told him that, and Mom too, but now everyone was gone, so what? He would if he wanted to.
But what was the no-talking man doing now?
Picked up the litter basket from the sidewalk, and he was going to...
What? Break Mr. Norton's window? Crash! By God and by damn if he didn't. And now he was reaching through, unlocking the door.
Hey, mister, you can't do that,
Tom cried, his voice throbbing with outrage and excitement.
That's illegal. M-O-O-N, and that spells illegal. Don't you know?
But the man was already inside, and he never turned around.
What are you, anyway, deaf?
Tom called indignantly.
My laws, are you...
He trailed off. The animation and excitement left his face. He was the robot with the pulled plug again. In May, it had not been an uncommon sight to see feeble Tom like this. He would be walking along the street, looking into shop windows with that eternally happy expression on his slightly rounded, Scandahoovian face, and all of a sudden he would stop dead and go blank. Someone might shout, "There goes Tom!" and there would be laughter. If Tom's daddy was with him, he would scowl and elbow Tom, perhaps even sock him repeatedly on the shoulder or the back until Tom came to life. But Tom's daddy had been around less and less after the first half of 1979, because he was stepping out with a red-headed waitress who worked at Boomer's Bar and Grill. Her name was Dee Dee Packalot. And weren't there some jokes about that name? And about a year ago, she and Don Cullen had run off together. Most folks took Tom's sudden blankouts as a further sign of retardation. But they were actually instances of nearly normal thinking. Tom Cullen was not severely retarded, and he was capable of making simple connections. Every now and then, during his blankouts, he would be capable of making a more sophisticated inductive or deductive connection. He would feel the possibility of making such a connection the way a normal person will sometimes feel a name dancing right on the tip of his tongue. When it happened, Tom would dismiss his real world, which was nothing more or less than an instant-by-instant flow of sensory input, and go into his mind. He would be like a man in a dark and unfamiliar room who holds the plug end of a lamp cord in one hand and who is crawling around on the floor, bumping into things and feeling with his free hand for the electrical socket. And if he found it, he didn't always. There would be a burst of illumination, and he would see the room, or the idea, plain.
Tom was a sensory creature. A list of his favorite things would have included the taste of an ice cream soda at Mr. Norton's fountain, watching a pretty girl in a short dress waiting on the corner to cross the street, the smell of lilac, the feel of silk. But more than any of these things, he loved the intangible. He loved that moment when the connection would be made, the switch cleared, at least momentarily. The light would go on in the dark room. It didn't always happen. Often the connection eluded him. This time it didn't. He had said, "What are you anyway, deaf?" The man hadn't acted like he heard what Tom was saying, except for those times he had been looking right at him. And the man hadn't said anything to him, not even hi. Sometimes people didn't answer Tom when he asked questions because something in his face told them he was soft upstairs. But this man didn't act like that was the reason. He had given Tom a circle made of his thumb and forefinger, and Tom knew that meant okie dokie. But still he didn't talk. Hands over his ears and a shake of his head. Hands over his mouth and the same. Hands over his neck and the same again. "My laws," Tom said, and the animation came back into his face. His bloodshot eyes glowed. He rushed into Norton's drugstore, forgetting that it was illegal to do so. The bike man was squirting something that smelled like Bactine into cotton and then wiping the cotton on his forehead. "Hey, mister," Tom said, rushing up. The bike man didn't turn around. Tom was momentarily puzzled, and then he remembered. He tapped Nick on the shoulder, and Nick turned. "You're deaf and dumb, right? Can't hear, can't talk, right?" Nick nodded. And to him, Tom's reaction was nothing short of amazing. He jumped into the air and clapped his hands wildly.
"I thought of it! Hooray for me! I thought of it myself! Hooray for Tom Cullen!"
Nick had to grin. He couldn't remember when his disability had brought someone so much pleasure. Nick slept in the park that night. He didn't know where Tom slept, but when he woke up the next morning, slightly dewy but feeling pretty good otherwise, the first thing he saw when he crossed the town square was Tom, crouched over a fleet of toy corgi cars and a large plastic Texaco station. He walked across the street and tapped Tom on the arm. Tom jumped and looked over his shoulder. A large and guilty smile stretched his lips, and a blush climbed out of his shirt collar. "I know it's for little boys and not for grown men," he said. "I know that. Laws, yes, Daddy told me." Nick shrugged, smiled, spread his hands. Tom looked relieved. "It's mine now. Mine if I want it. If you could go in the drug and get something, so could I. I don't have to put it back, do I?" Nick shook his head. "Mine," Tom said happily, and turned back to the garage. Nick tapped him again, and Tom looked back. "What?" Nick tugged his sleeve, and Tom stood up willingly enough. Nick led him down the street to where his bike leaned on its kickstand. He pointed to himself, then at the bike. Tom nodded. "Sure, that bike is yours. That Texaco garage is mine. I won't take your bike and you won't take my garage. Laws, no." Nick shook his head. He pointed at himself, at the bike, then down Main Street. He waved his fingers. "Bye-bye." Tom became very still. Nick waited. Tom said hesitantly, "You moving on, mister?" Nick nodded. "I don't want you to," Tom burst out. His eyes were wide and very blue, sparkling with tears. "I like you. I don't want you to go." Nick nodded. He pulled Tom next to him and put an arm around him, pointed to himself, to Tom, to the bike, out of town. "I don't get you," Tom said. Patiently, Nick went through it again. This time he added the bye-bye wave, and in a burst of inspiration, he lifted Tom's hand and made it wave bye-bye, too. "Want me to go with you?" Tom asked. A smile of disbelieving delight lit up his face. Relieved, Nick nodded.
"Sure," Tom shouted. "Tom Cullen's gonna go. Tom's..."
He halted, some of the happiness dying out of his face.
"Can I take my garage?"
Nick thought about it a moment and then nodded his head. Okay. Tom's grin reappeared like the sun from behind a cloud. Tom Collins going. Nick led him to the bike. He pointed at Tom, then at the bike. I never rode one like that, Tom said doubtfully, eyeing the bike's gear shift and the high, narrow seat. I guess I better not. Tom Cullen would fall off a fancy bike like that. But Nick was provisionally encouraged. I never rode one like that meant that he had ridden some sort of bike. It was only a question of finding a nice, simple one. Tom was going to slow him down, that was inevitable, but perhaps not too much after all. And what was the hurry, anyway? Dreams were only dreams. But he did feel an inner urge to hurry, something so strong yet undefinable that it amounted to a subconscious command. He led Tom back to his filling station. He pointed at it, then smiled and nodded at Tom. Tom squatted down eagerly, and then his hands paused in the act of reaching for a couple of cars. He looked up at Nick, his face troubled and transparently suspicious. You ain't gonna go without Tom Cullen, are you? Nick shook his head firmly. Okay, Tom said, and turned confidently to his toys. Before he could stop himself, Nick had ruffled the man's hair. Tom looked up and smiled shyly at him. Nick smiled back. No, he couldn't just leave him. That was sure. It was almost noon before he found a bike which he thought would suit Tom. He hadn't expected it to take anywhere near as long as it did, but a surprising majority of people had locked their houses, garages, and outbuildings. In most cases, he was reduced to peering into shadowy garages through dirty, cobwebby windows, hoping to spot the right bike. At one point, he had gone back to recheck the Western Auto, but that was no good. The two bikes in the show window were his and hers three speeds, and everything else was unassembled. In the end, he found what he was looking for in a small detached garage at the southern end of town. The garage was locked, but it had one window big enough to crawl through. Nick broke the glass with a rock and carefully picked the remaining slivers out of the old crumbling putty. Inside the garage was explosively hot and furry with a thick oil and dust smell. The bike, an old-fashioned boy's Schwinn, stood next to a 10-year-old Merck station wagon. The way my luck's running, the damn bike will be busted, Nick thought. No chain, flat tires, something. But this time his luck was in. The bike rolled easily. The tires were up and had good tread. All the bolts and sprockets seemed tight. There was no bike basket. He would have to remedy that, but there was a chain guard and hung neatly on the wall, an unexpected bonus, a nearly new Briggs hand pump. He tied the bike pump to the package carrier on the Schwinn's back fender with a hank of hay rope, then unlocked the garage door and ran it up. Fresh air had never smelled so sweet. He closed his eyes and inhaled it deeply, then wheeled the bike out to the road, got on, and pedaled slowly down Main Street. The bike rode fine. It would be just the ticket for Tom, assuming he really could ride it. He parked it beside his Raleigh and went into the Five and Dime. He found a good-sized wire bike basket in a jumble of sporting goods near the back of the store and was turning to leave with it under his arm when something else caught his eye. A klaxon horn with a chrome bell and a large red rubber bulb. Grinning, Nick put the horn in the basket and then went over to the hardware section for a screwdriver and an adjustable wrench. He went back outside. Tom was sprawled peacefully in the shade of the World War II Marine in the town square, napping. He put the basket on the Schwinn's handlebars and attached the klaxon horn beside it. He went back into the Five and Dime and came out with a good-sized tote bag. He took it up to the A&P and filled it with canned meat, fruit, and vegetables. He was pausing over some canned chili beans when he saw a shadow flit by on the aisle facing him. If he had been able to hear, he would already have been aware that Tom had discovered his bike. The klaxon's hoarse and drawn-out cry of "Howga!" floated up and down the street, punctuated by Tom Cullen's giggles. Nick pushed out through the supermarket stores and saw Tom speeding grandly down Main, his blonde hair and his shirt tail whipping out behind him, squeezing the bulb of the klaxon horn for all it was worth. At the Arco station that marked the end of the business section, he whirled around and pedaled back. There was a huge and triumphant grin on his face. The Fisher-Price garage sat in the bike basket. His pants pockets and the flap pockets of his khaki shirt bulged with scale model Corgi cars. The sun flashed bright, revolving circles in the wheel spokes. A little wistfully, Nick wished he could hear the sound of the horn, just to see if it pleased him as much as it was pleasing Tom. Tom brought the bike to a skidding halt in front of Nick. Sweat stood out on his face in great beads. The bike pump's rubber hose flopped. Tom was panting and grinning. Nick pointed out of town and waved bye-bye. "Can I still take my garage?" Nick nodded and slipped the strap of the tote bag over Tom's bull neck. "We going right now?" Nick nodded again. He made a circle with his thumb and forefinger. "Wow," Tom said happily. "Okay, yeah, wow." Nick went back to his own bike, slipped into his pack, and got on. Tom watched him ride up, his face alight with furious anticipation. Nick clapped him on the shoulder. They rode out of town side by side, Tom still squeezing the bulb of his horn. They camped that night in left field of the Roston J.C.'s Little League ball field. The evening was cloudless and starry. Nick's sleep came quickly and was dreamless. He woke up at dawn next morning, thinking how good it was to be with someone again, what a difference it made. He had a battered Rand McNally road atlas in his pack, and while he waited for Tom to wake up, he sat cross-legged in a sleeping bag lifted from the Roston sporting goods and tried to plot a course. There really was a Polk County, Nebraska. At first, that had given him a start, but he had traveled all over the last few years. He must have talked to somebody who mentioned Polk County or had come from Polk County, and his conscious mind had just forgotten it. There was a Route 30, too, but he couldn't really believe, at least not in the bright day of this early morning, that they were actually going to find an old Negro woman sitting on her porch in the middle of a field of corn and accompanying herself on a guitar while she sang hymns. He didn't believe in precognition or in visions, but it seemed important to go somewhere to look for people. In a way, he shared Fran Goldsmith's and Stu Redmond's urge to regroup. Until that could be done, everything would remain alien and out of joint. There was danger everywhere. You couldn't see it, but you could feel it. Danger. Every particle of his being seemed to whisper it. Bridge out. 40 miles of bad road. We are not responsible for persons proceeding beyond this point. Part of it was the tremendous, walloping psychological shock of the empty countryside. He remembered a Walt Disney movie he had seen as a kid, a nature thing. Filling the screen was this tulip, this one tulip, so beautiful it just made you want to hold your breath. Then the camera pulled back with dizzying suddenness, and you saw a whole field filled with tulips. It knocked you flat. It produced total sensory overload, and some internal circuit breaker fell with a sizzle, cutting off the input. It was too much. And that was how this trip had been. Shoyo was empty, and he could adjust to that. But McNabb was empty, too. And Texarkana, and Spencerville. Ardmore had burned right to the ground. He had come north on Highway 81 and had only seen two living people, and they had run away from him like deer. Twice he had seen signs, a campfire perhaps 2 days old, and a deer that had been shot and neatly cleaned out. But no people. It was enough to screw you all up, because the enormity of it was steadily creeping up on you. It wasn't just Shoyo or McNabb or Texarkana. It was America, lying there like a huge discarded tin can with a few forgotten peas rolling around in the bottom. And beyond America was the whole world. And thinking of that made Nick feel so dizzy and sick that he had to give up.